We're going to get started. We don't have quorum yet, so we're going to get started here in the first bill, and then we'll call the meeting to order as we proceed. Welcome to the Property Tax Committee. Representative Sundin and Mr. He will introduce his guest. Representative Sundin, if you'd introduce your bill and then your guest.
Thank you, Chairman. This is Carlton County Commissioner Marv Bodie, and he's here to speak to 873. This is a measure that will enable Carlton County to levy for recreational purposes in Sawyer Township here. It's probably the shortest bill that you're going to see today, and it's got the most paperwork behind it. There's letters from the Carlton County Auditor Treasurer in regards to this, and Commissioner Bodie will address some of the issues in that communication. There is a tax impact statement here, and there's actually no impact. It's negligible. So I'd like to have Marv Bodie speak to the needs for this measure.
Mr. Bodie, welcome. If you would introduce yourself for the record and proceed, sir.
My name is Marv Bodie, Chair of the Carlton County Board. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We're looking for it's actually extension of some old language that allowed a rural township to donate money towards a recreation area in their adjoining city. It's a whopping $1,500 per year, but the previous language sunsetted in 2006, and they wish to continue contributing towards the efforts, the building, the hockey arena needs remodeling with their cooling system. So they are more stepping up to contribute towards that. Right now, with unorganized townships, we can contribute money for road and bridges, fire protection, mosquito control, but recreation is not one of the items we can contribute to. So this language will allow those residents to contribute towards that cost.
Thank you, Mr. Bodie. Members, we do have quorum. I will call the meeting of the Property Taxes and a local government finance committee to order. Thank you, Representative Sundin and Mr. Bodie, for introducing your bill. And I believe that Representative Davney will move House File 873 to be considered for being laid over and possible inclusion.
So moved, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Davney. Members, are any questions for Representative Sundin or Mr. Bodie on the bill before us, House File 873? Okay, seeing and hearing none, thank you, Representative Sundin, thank you, Mr. Bodie, and thanks for coming down from Carlton to talk to us today about this bill. And with that, the chair will lay over House File 873.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members, we have the minutes before us of the last meeting, that being the March 4th meeting. The chair would entertain a motion to approve. Representative Lean.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lean. Representative Lean moves to approve the March 4th minutes. Any additions, corrections? Seeing none, all in favor of approving the March 4th minutes, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion passes. The minutes are adopted. And our next bill on the agenda will be Representative Anzels, and that's House File 1362. The chair would entertain a motion regarding that bill for a layover and possible inclusion. Representative Anderson?
I would move that bill, Mr. Chair, House File 1362.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson moves House File 1362 be moved for to be laid over and for possible inclusion. Representative Anzels, thank you for coming together or coming before us with your bill again today. Please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good morning. This is your second township bill for your hearing today. Essentially, in 2013, the legislature created a new township aid account, and for whatever reason, a reporting requirement was not included in the legislation for townships in order to receive the aid. With me this morning is a representative from the Minnesota Township Association, a familiar face, Mr. Kent Zulum, and he and I are very interested in answering any questions that you might have. Essentially, this standardizes the reporting process for local units of government who receive aid, municipalities, and now townships. Stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Anzels. Mr. Sulem, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kent Sulem, General Counsel and Director of Governmental Relations for the Minnesota Association of Townships. And as Representative Anzels said, House File 1362 is simply a housekeeping bill that will treat townships in the same manner as other local governments receiving aid. In the 2013 tax bill, the aid formula was put in place for townships, restoring our township aid after 13-year absence. However, as he indicated, there was no specific reporting requirements and sign-off. And in 2014, when the Department of Revenue reached out to the state auditor for that certification, it became apparent that there was no authority to give that certification. And so, therefore, for 1 year, we essentially received money that, trust us, will account for it, and they are good. I mean, we, out of our 1,800 townships, just shy of 1,800 townships, we only have a small number that failed to get their reports in, and this is just one more way of giving the incentive and treating everything equally. So we are willing to accept this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Sulem. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sulem, when I was a town clerk, it was the old paper and pencil form. Is there a new software package townships can use now to file these reports in a timely fashion?
Mr. Sulem.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, yes. We actually, a couple of years ago, came before the tax committee in the budget process and got authorization to help fund CTAS 8. I think it's 8.1 is now the version, and that allows townships to very simply comply with all reporting requirements, auditing requirements, and pretty much at a push of a button can submit the report. It's not a mandate, so there are townships that are not computer savvy and don't wish to do that, and that's fine. We still have the paper, but yes, we did get that new CTAS, and it was launched earlier this year.
Thank you, Mr. Sulem, Representative Anderson. Other questions, members? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Sulem, have these township officials been trained so they know now how to file these reports so I won't get concerns from my township officials in my very small townships that they don't have the personnel to do this?
Mr. Sulem.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, the reporting requirement actually has been law for many, 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 many decades. It's not a new requirement. It's just there wasn't the tie-in for certifying that they complied with the law before they receive their aid checks, which is a requirement for cities and counties. We've been telling them for a year now that this bill was coming. We've been trying to reach out to them at all of our short courses, which again start next Monday. So they are aware of it. We do our best for training. Can I promise 100% satisfaction? No, I cannot, but we will do our best.
Mr. Sulem, what about the revenue note mentions 1,746 townships would be affected. How many townships are there in the state? Again, if you remind us of that, and what is the default rate on reporting normally for the rest of those townships?
Mr. Chair, our number is there's 1,783 townships in the state, and we represent 1,781 of them. So I'm not sure where the 46 number came from.
Oh, okay. I read it improperly. Thank you. So of those townships, how many normally default on their report?
Well, Mr. Chair, traditionally it had been around 80, 85 that we had been seeing that were a little slow. We'd have to work with them, and the state auditor's office has been very good at helping those communities come into play, into compliance. And usually it came about because of a change in clerks. There was a turnover, as you know, or hopefully you know, yesterday was Township Day. The elections were held and the budgets were set for next year. And as the new clerks came in and the old clerks hadn't finished the reports, there would be that gap. Unfortunately, last year we did have a few more. We were up about 140 that originally were out of compliance, and we've been steadily working with the auditor to bring that number down and get everybody back into compliance.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I was hoping somebody else would ask this because I must be the only one that doesn't know. What is an unorganized township?
Mr. Sulem.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, thank you for that question. I didn't want to have to interrupt on Representative Sandin's bill. There is no such thing as an unorganized township. It's unorganized territory. Unorganized territory is that property within a county boundary that has neither a city or a township form of government. And so therefore it defaults to being county property, county land. The reference to unorganized township is more of a colloquialism, referencing back to the congressional townships back with the Northwest ordinance that created the state of Minnesota and organized our units of government up through there. But technically the correct term in statute is unorganized territory.
Other questions, members?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Dabney.
Since we've been on this issue before, isn't Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport unorganized territory?
Mr. Sulem.
Mr. Chair.
I know it doesn't have a township board.
Mr. Sulem has another job as Minneapolis and St. Paul expert.
I am a resident of the fine township of Minneapolis, yes.
Yeah.
but I honestly could not tell you. I've never looked into that, but I'll try to get an answer for you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Other questions, members, comments? Any other final comments, Representative Anzel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As some of you know, I'm actually a resident of a township in northern Minnesota, Balsam Township, where the trees grow beautifully. So I ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Anzel. With that, the chair would lay over House File 1362 for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now, Mr. Chair, if you would bring your bill next, and then we'll have Representative Mason and Pinto. Thank you for coming, Mr. Chair. Please introduce your bill. Oh, yeah, we need to move it, don't we? Representative Whalen, would you like to move Chair David's bill? Thank you. Representative Whalen moves House File 1123 for possible inclusion. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Whalen, for moving House File 1123. This bill represents the work of a development finance task force convened by the League of Minnesota Cities. For the past 2 years, the task force has worked with the state auditor and nonpartisan legislative staff to draft legislation that would clarify provisions in the TIF statute where there was confusion or disagreement about how the language should be interpreted. And the process, at the beginning of the process, there were a number of other provisions that were discussed. However, the parties did not reach consensus on that language, and these provisions were removed for future consideration. The language before the committee represents a consensus. The bill gives taxing authorities some additional flexibility and reduces administrative burdens, while maintaining transparency and giving the state all of the information it needs for oversight. I want to be very clear. I'm not aware of any opposition to this bill, and I do need to say that the auditor's office is enthusiastically neutral.
Is that like being a resource, Mr. Chair?
No, not at all. Being a resource is not good. They're not a resource. They are neutral. So, with that, I have a gentleman here from the League that would have a few comments, and then we'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Chair Davids. Mr. Hines, if you'd introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Patrick Hines. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to thank Representative Davids for carrying this legislation. As he noted, it has been a long process where we have had city officials, representatives from the state auditor's office, nonpartisan legislative staff, working on language to clarify provisions in the TIF statute. There are two primary substantive portions of the bill. The first is Section 1, which expands the definition of administrative expenses to include usual and customary maintenance costs associated with a TIF district. This This deals with a dispute that arose over whether a city that is maintaining a TIF property could pay for the maintenance of the property, snow plowing or mowing the lawn, weeding the ditch while it's in city possession. Cities felt that this was an allowable administrative expense under the TIF statute. The auditor disagreed, and that was one of the impetuses for our two-year-long meeting, and we came to the conclusion that it would be appropriate if the legislature agreed to allow an administrative expense to include that maintenance. I'll note that administrative expenses are tax increment, but they are capped at 10% of the total estimated tax increment expenditures, so there's a natural and existing cap on how much a city could spend on administrative expenses. The next substantive section makes changes to the interfund loan section of the TIF statute. Again, this is clarifying when and in what manner an interfund loan is necessary. An interfund loan is essentially tracking when a city may make a payment out of its general fund for a TIF purpose and then reimburse itself with increment as increment comes into the district. What this language does is allows a city to do that as a writing instead of as a formal council measure. It makes it easier for cities. They don't have to call special meetings in order to make a transfer. They don't have to have a council meet to pass a resolution. What they will have to do is provide all of the documentation to the state auditor as part of its annual TIF report, and this, we feel, maintains the transparency that's necessary for the auditor to do its job. The language also excludes certain types of expenditures from the interfund loan resolution requirement. For example, before a TIF district is created, there are upfront costs that are necessary to create the district. They could be soil studies if you're doing a redevelopment of a brownfield, for example. There are technical requirements to creating the TIF district, whether it's a financial advisor or an attorney, those type of things. So those costs would be excluded from the interfund loan resolution requirement altogether. And then the other portion I should note is that it clarifies that an interfund loan resolution can be formatted as a drawdown. Currently, cities do that. It's unclear whether the statute doesn't prohibit it, but it doesn't explicitly say you can. And we thought it would be best if we just clarified that a city can do an interfund loan resolution as a drawdown. And again, as Representative Davids noted, the auditor participated in our discussions and provided guidance and technical assistance, and they are neutral on the bill. I'm not aware of any opposition, and I stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hines, on line point 1.23, capital reserves caught my attention. When the TIF district ends, if a city has maintained that 10% capital reserve, what happens to the disposition of that at the end of the TIF district? Where does the money go? Is it just transferred to their general fund, or how is that captured, or should it be expensed out in year 9?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hertaus, the money in that capital reserve is still increment. And so at the end of the district life, it would have to be treated, I believe, the same as any other increment. So if it was excess increment at the end of the duration, it would then be distributed as excess increment to the taxing authorities.
Okay.
Other Representative Hertaus?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That clarified that question.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And looking in the bottom half of page 6, if you're basically saying that you don't have to hold it in the meeting, you just notify the auditor. If you're allowing 60 days after transfer, once you have a normally scheduled meeting within those 60 days to perform that business, so why would you not need to schedule it into a meeting?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, I think that, I mean, you raise a good point that, you know, within 60 days, a city is generally going to have a meeting. I think the question and the issue is more whether we need to have a formal council meeting convene and adopt a resolution for all of these instances. And this would allow the city council to, by resolution, authorize its financial officer to make these interfund loan transfers like it does with most other city business. Generally, a council is not going to convene to approve payment of bills or other city matters. So we think this is, you would have the resolution authorizing the city official to do that. They would do that as necessary throughout the life of the TIF district, and that information would be part of the annual TIF report that's filed.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure, maybe my district is a little unusual, but I have always have people that are concerned about or tiffed off about something to do with this program. And if you're going to have 60 days and have a regular meeting, which I'm not aware of there being more than 2 month gap, I don't really agree with not having it transparent so that it'd be visible. In other words, I think especially since you're adding verbiage to give it 60 days, that there really isn't a justification not to allow it to be included in a meeting for transparency.
Comments, Mr. Hines?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Kwan. I would point out that this only applies to an interfund loan resolution, so all of the other substantive requirements of creating a TIF district are still subject to the normal public hearing and notice requirements. We're talking about an instance where a payment is made, an authorized payment is made for within a TIF district, and the city is doing it out of its general fund, and then will later be reimbursed from increment. So it's not, I understand what your concern is. I think that because we're only dealing with these interfund loan resolutions, I think that concern is less than if we were trying to change the notice process of when a district was created or how long the duration would be, those type of issues.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand the minute point this is. However, some people feel the principle of chipping away at transparency accumulates over time, and I just thought I would voice my discomfort. Thank you.
Thanks, Representative Kwan. Representative Joachim.
Just a quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hines, just to clarify in my head, last city council meeting I had was December of 2014, but this would be like a resolution like we do when we do disbursements to pay other bills, right?
Mr.
So
Hines.
It would be listed under the resolutions and motions at the beginning of the meeting.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair and Representative Joachim, I believe that would be the case, but despite representing the League of Minnesota Cities, I generally do not attend city council meetings, nor do I approve their resolution. So I'm a little hesitant to say for certain that it is the same.
Mr. Michael, phone a friend.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that'd be kind of like Warren Buffett not drinking Coke.
Is it Mexican sugar in a Coke?
Pure sugar. Pure sugar.
Pure cane. Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Joaquin, I think that will vary from city to city. They have probably different processes, but the way you suggested, I think it would be pretty common that this would be done just as sort of the routine business at the end of the meeting after you've, but I don't think you can necessarily generalize about the procedures that every city uses.
Representative Joaquin.
I was just trying to, so we have resolutions when we do disbursements to pay the bills, so they're still printed in the resolutions on the agenda, notified to the public, and also the public can come and get all the checks that we've written and see what's going on. So it would still be somewhat of a transfer. It would be a transparent process still, just is in my mind, if I'm understanding how the language is written.
Thank you, Representative Joaquin. Mr. Michael has some words.
What the bill authorizes would not require a resolution. That's the key thing to understand with this, is that basically what we're talking about is, you know, essentially staff people completing paperwork that documents what's happened. As Mr. Hines indicated, a lot of what the conflict that's occurred here is that basically what happens is when the auditor comes in after the fact and is unraveling the way TIF funds have been handled, what has happened in the past is that they've discovered that, I mean, actually what generates this typically is the city finds out that they have more increment than what they really thought that they would get. And if you don't have a way to, within the boundaries of the TIF plan, spend that increment, as Mr. Hines indicated, what then happens is that that increment has to be essentially go back to the governmental entities that impose the taxes that generated that increment. So that means some of it will go to the county, some of it will go to the city, and some of it will go to the school district. That's obviously not what the cities would like to have happen. They want to keep all of the increment in their economic development funds if possible. And so oftentimes what's found is that, gee, we didn't have in place a resolution passed by the city council before this happened that authorized us to back some of these funds out back to our water fund or back to our general fund. And what this bill allows them to do is to essentially within 60 days after the expenditures have been made to just, you know, file paperwork to have that occur, so that it's more like a bookkeeping entry. This is not like checks being written out to third parties, to vendors or something like that. So essentially what it does is it gives them more flexibility to document that they can transfer money back from their increment funds back to the water fund or back to the general fund or something like that.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. Other questions, members? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Davids, is this going to make TIF financing more attractive? Because I think we've been in decline when it comes to tax incremental financing. So will these clarifications and some of these modifications make it more attractive, or isn't this a factor in that?
Chair Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Chair Erickson. I think it makes it easier to administer overall. And so, of course, my background being a former mayor, I liked using TIF. We had some very successful TIF projects, and that seemed to be the way we could do some things in a small town. And so I think this just makes it easier for the city to operate through the TIF statute.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question might be for Mr. Michael, but I see in the language under the interfund loan section where it talks about, you know, sort of amending these written terms before the latest termination of the TIF district, and then I see in the House research notes where you mention sort of the vagueness between the definition of termination and decertification, and I'm just wondering if you can speak to that, so I can maybe understand in statute what the difference is between termination and decertification of a TIF.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simonson, decertification occurs when, just to back up a second to review so everybody understands, including new members of the division, how tax increment works. It involves freezing the tax base. So the, you know, and I think all of you who, like Representative Simonson or former city officials, fully understand how this mechanically works, is that the auditor will come in and say at the beginning of the TIF district that, okay, any growth, any increase in tax capacity, the taxes that are paid by that increase are going to then be increment and will go into the tax increment fund. And so that's really the crucial mechanics that causes TIF to work the way it does, that generates the revenue that's used then to pay for qualifying costs. decertification occurs very clearly when the property tax administrators say that process is over and that captured tax capacity that is above that frozen amount goes back into the general tax base. So that's what, if the bill said decertification, that would be when the property tax administrators have essentially returned that captured tax capacity to the regular tax rolls. That doesn't mean that the tax increment district itself is done. They may still have money in their bank accounts, and they may still have activities that their tax increment plans allow them to spend money on. And so when the bill says termination, to me it's unlikely to mean decertification. What it likely means is when they've gotten to the process where they've completed all of their activities, so they've spent their money and they've returned it all, and they basically have terminated or shut down the activities of the tax increment district. I think that's what the difference is between termination and decertification. But termination is not so much a term of art in the tax increment district that I know exactly what it means, which is why when I wrote the summary, I said I don't know exactly.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Michael, for that. And my final question, I guess, would be just to Chair Davids, if that makes sense to you and if that matches what your intent is in the bill. I just wanted to be sure.
Well, Chair Davids. Mr. Chair, and Representative Simonson, I don't understand a thing he said. maybe we can go to Mr. Hines. And it's not because of Mr. Michael, I'll tell you that.
Mr. Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Simonson. We did discuss the difference between termination and decertification when Mr. Michael released the research summary, and it's interesting. Well, it's not interesting. I'll just say that decertification says, references the termination of a district. So decertification is a term of art. Termination is not. If it's clearer to use decertification, because everyone knows precisely when that occurs, we would be happy to change the bill to make that clear. We were just trying to put some natural end on when that amendment could be, and if decertification works better, we're happy to do that.
Thank you. Mr. Michael, where are we looking in the bill? Which line are we looking at on the bill for that?
Mr. Chairman, it's on page 7, line 3, where it says, before the latest termination of the tax increment district. I think if you wanted to use decertification as the benchmark, the way to do that would be to say, the amendment would read that on page 7, line 3, delete latest termination and insert decertification.
Representative Simonson.
Mr. Chair, I'm not passionate one way or the other. I was really looking for clarification, but if it would please the author and the testifier to make that change, we certainly could. But if they would choose to stay with the term termination, I don't have any heartburn one way or another, but if you like the other term better, I'd be willing to offer that amendment.
Chair Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Simonson. I think that would be clear if we did what Mr. Michael said on 7.3, delete latest termination, put recertification.
Decertification, Mr. Chair.
Can't read my own.
Mr. Michael, can you read to us how it should read?
Mr. Chairman, then it would read, before the decertification of the tax increment district from which the interfund loan will be paid.
Representative Simonson moves to, on line 7.3, strike the word termination and insert the word decertification. Is that correct, Mr. Michael? Any discussion on the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I think you also need to strike the word latest on 7.3.
Oh, I am sorry. So if you want to restate your amendment, Representative Simonson.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we amend House File 1123 by striking the words latest and termination from 7.3 and inserting the word decertification.
Thank you. Any discussion on the amendment? Representative Quam.
Thank you. Even though there's probably a fiscal impact because it would be less billable hours, since it would be more understandable, I still support this amendment.
Thank you. Any other discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of Representative Simonson's amendment to on line 7.3 strike the words latest in termination and insert the word decertification, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion passes. We will... all opposed, no. Motion still passes. Okay. Any other discussion on the bill? Chair Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and thank you, Representative Simonson, for catching that. I was kind of in unfamiliar territory because if you look at the revenue note, there's no cost, and I'm not used to carrying bills like that. But that's the way it goes. So I'd appreciate your support, and thank you for your work on this bill.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a question on what Mr. Michael talked about, transferring out of the fund to the water fund, for example, at the end of the TIF period. Are those funds that technically should be going back to the school or the county, or could you just explain that again, please?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I think the short answer to that is probably no. What happens is that there are the TIF law sets up things that you can use tax increment to pay for, and of course many of those things are also things, probably almost all of them are also things that you can use the city's general fund or the water fund to pay for. And what's happening with this instance is that the city has paid for those expenses out of its water fund or its general fund, let's say, and then they discover that, you know, shortly after that, in this case 60 days would be the limit, that hey, we could also pay for this out of tax increment, that we've got enough tax increment to pay for that. And of course they would prefer to do that for the reason that you obviously recognize quickly, is that gee, if we pay for it out of the general fund and then we have extra tax increment that's left, and the law then requires us to share that with the county and the school and the special districts, you know, we're better off transferring it back to the general fund. And, you know, and it's perfectly legal if it's done within the processes that are required by the tax increment law. And, of course, you're making them a little more flexible now, so it'll be easier for them to do that.
Representative Anderson. Thank you, Mr. Michael. And, members, we are in TIF day here in the Property Tax Committee. And as Representative Quam pointed out, nobody's been TIFed off yet. You guys didn't catch that, but I did. Any other questions? Thank you, Representative Davids. With that, and Mr. Hines, Representative Davids, I think you, or Chair Davids, you gave your closing comments.
Your support.
Thank you. All in favor, with that, the Chair lays over House File 1123 for possible inclusion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
The Chair lays it over as amended. We got it corrected. Thank you. And Representative Mason, there she is. Representative Mason, welcome to the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Committee. Representative Marquardt, would you move the bill?
So move.
Thank you. Representative Marquardt moves House File 1299. We'll put my cheaters back on for possible inclusion, to be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Mason, if you would introduce your bill for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 1299 is requesting a tax increment financing extension. And just a little history, many years ago when 77 Highway 77 bridge was put through Egan, they essentially cut off Highway 13, which was the main access to our major shopping center. And ever since then, that district had gone down. Eventually, the city did decide to do the redevelopment. And right now, that is where the outlet mall is. And so for those of you who haven't been there, I encourage you to do that. It's only a portion of it, but I will let the mayor go over the details of the bill for you.
Thank you, Mayor. If you would introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike McGuire. I am the proud mayor of Eagan, Minnesota. I want to thank the chair and committee for taking the time to discuss House File 1299. Also want to thank Representative Mason and in his absence, Representative David as well for authoring this legislation. As Representative Mason made reference to, and I'll try to be as brief as possible, this is a TIF district that has been in place for a number of years in the city of Eagan. We were here last year because it is a TIF district that has been uniquely impacted by the recession a few years ago. We've identified in the TIF district a financing gap at the end of the term of the district, and upon identifying that, came to the legislature last year trying to find some way of getting relief from that. We were successful at getting a piece of legislation that offered some mechanisms for relief. The major portion of that was a three-year extension of the TIF district's term. That extension required the approvals of the City of Eagan, of Dakota County, and of School District 191, in which the actual TIF district is. The City of Eagan and Dakota County unanimously approved that three-year extension. School Board 191 ultimately, after a fair amount of discussion about the measure, opted not to vote one way or the other on the extension. That effectively vetoed the approval of both the city and the county for the overall extension. So our take was that that wasn't the intention of the legislature when they offered that relief. Our intention in this bill is to offer up a way to not necessarily usurp the school district's authority to represent and vote in the best interest, as it sees it, of its property taxpayers, but to also not let that decision effectively overrule the decisions on their own taxpayers' basis of both the city and the county. One of the things that I think it's incumbent to point out, and I think that you've all been handed a map, is one of the things that we've identified in this process is thus far we can't find an instance where a TIF extension has been granted and a school district hasn't been on board with it. And that doesn't rule out the possibility of it having happened or the legitimacy, quite frankly, of a school district not wanting to participate in a TIF extension. Eagan, in this situation, the TIF district is located in about 15% of the city of Eagan. So that that taxing district represents a portion of Eagan, but only 15% of our property taxpayers. Only one board member is from the city of Eagan. The others are from outside of the community. And the majority of taxpayers in the city of Eagan are not represented by and didn't vote for the School District 191 board. So what we've asked is that we amend that legislation, that we have a three-year extension that addresses that financing gap, but does not include any School District 191 increment that would ordinarily fund go to their general fund upon 2029, I believe it is, and allow the county and the city to continue the or to move the three-year extension. There are any number of ways of doing this. This bill proposes this. I want to make it really clear here. Not trying to usurp the legitimate authority of the school district to represent its taxpayers. We are trying to limit that ability to the taxpayers that they represent and still be able to, as a city and a county, represent our taxpayers in that interest as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGuire. Mr. Hohenstein, do you want to say a few words? If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Hohenstein. I'm the Director of Community Development for the City of Eagan, and I really don't have anything to add to Mayor's comments, but I am available for questions if they come up.
Thank you, Mr. Hohenstein. Members' questions? Representative Hertaus.
Maybe not so much a question, Mr. Chair, but a comment for the members to consider. TIF district, when it's established, the county and the school district get dragged along, they don't have discretion to opt in or opt out. That's the way it works. So here we're establishing perhaps a precedent that is allowing any district that is extended to really usurp the process of getting an extension with the legislature. And it sounds like that's happening, and I guess I'm a little confused by that. Does anybody in the committee here, or maybe our researchers, have some comments on that?
Mr. Michael, if you could bring some clarity to that and the interaction of, and I'm not an expert on special law, so if you could kind of outline that for us, too.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is a fairly complicated kind of issue because it relates to approval of special laws, which the chair is being modest in saying he doesn't know a lot about, because I know, having talked to him, that he understands a lot of this. But the rule for special laws is that, and this is a constitutional provision that the voters approved back in the 19th century when they felt that the legislature was abusing special laws. To restrict special laws, you know, and special laws, just to keep in mind, are laws that apply to less than the entire state. They apply, you know, a classic special law would have been a law that authorized a corporation to be formed or something like that. But special laws, and those are totally prohibited now as a result of this legislation. But special laws that relate to one or more local units of government, but not all local units of government, are permissible. But under the Constitution, they're only permissible if they're subject to approval by the affected unit of government, unless there's a general law that says that they're not there's no local approval required. For tax increment district extensions, as Representative Hertas alluded to, unlike creation of a TIF district, all of the affected major taxing districts have to approve it. So, as what was the case with Egan, basically the school, the city, and the county have to approve the extension for it to take effect. If one of them fails to approve it, as Egan discovered, then it doesn't take effect for any of them. And I agree with the testimony from the mayor of Egan that this is the first instance that I'm aware of where one of the affected units of government has decided not to approve an extension. Now, there were extensions before this law that required that essentially the general law that said all three of the local units of government, the three major taxing districts, are affected units of government, was enacted in 1995. And so there were extensions before that that only required city approval. But the reason why the legislature in 1995 decided to require approval by the school and the county, in addition to the city, who is the one that's always requesting the extension, was to protect them, to protect their tax base. With an extension, typically with the creation of a new TIF district, the argument is, gee, this property would not be there because unless we form the TIF district and provide incentives, the developer will not develop the property. It's the classic old but-for argument. Then Representative Rest, who was the author of this provision, now Senator Rest, concluded, hey, that's probably not true when you have an extension, because in an extension, like in this case in Egan, the development has already occurred. The property is there. The city here, unfortunately, has a gap that they can't meet. But the property's there. So the overlapping districts can say, gee, you can't say, you know, maybe yes, maybe no. But the property, if the normal process would go through, that property would go back on the tax rolls and we would have the revenue from it during the extension. So it seemed in the legislature's mind back in 1995 that it would be more appropriate in that case to let require each of the units to approve an extension because their tax base is being kept away from them. what the city is saying here is, well, probably a better way to do that would be to give them not a veto over the city's ability to continue to capture its taxes and the county's authority to capture its taxes, but only your own taxes. So rather than giving a veto, it would just protect their interest, which is the school's interest in getting the taxes that are attributable to their levy. So that's sort of a long discourse on what's going on with all of this and how the rules have changed and how it's tied up with these special law approval requirements. Another option for this, obviously, would be to change the general law and say that as a general practice, when we have extensions, that rather than giving the county and the school a veto, that they would only be able to say, you can't take my levy and capture it as part of tax increment. The city, and you know, they're just trying to get their extension with regard to the city and the county, not take on that larger challenge.
So, Mr. Michael, with this bill, the city would capture its increment on its portion of property taxes. The school and the county would just be normal.
Mr. Chairman, in this case, the county has actually approved it, so they would also capture the county taxes. But you're right; that's the idea.
Representative Hertas, well,
thank you for the explanation, and I guess I'll end my comment right there.
Other questions, Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and frankly, looking at page 2 and the effect, because one or more other affected locality or local government units approve, this basically says that out of the three, if only one of them approves, it's extended. And that causes some discomfort in the fact that if you're interacting as three entities for something, but only one of the three can keep it going, I don't think you really have a consensus to be able to say that's a cooperative effort. That's more, we feel that we're, have single control. So, I mean, that is disconcerting. I'm wrestling with the implications with the school districts and the following verbiage. And so, frankly, I agree that this will set a precedent because this is special, treated special by the state, and that intent is to be limiting what we tend to muddy up. I'm reluctant to make it even more murky by allowing this with some of these provisions. Because this is not a single case. This is a precedent on a very, forgive the pun, special portion of law that we are supposed to, as a legislature, tread somewhat delicately because of constitutional concerns. And I am reluctant to put forth a precedent with some of the things that this implies.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I have the same reservations on this because of precedent. Because I could see where other districts will have the same issues that will pop up from time to time and therefore want a special exception. I do have a question. I'm not sure if it's Mr. Hines or who, but is there a way that the municipality and the county could contribute to the TIF district without the extension, or is that such that once that TIF district ends, there can't be a voluntary contribution by entities that choose to participate?
Mr. Michael?
Or Mr. Michael, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vogel, now you're getting into sort of city spending and county spending power, and I'm honestly not an expert on. I know a lot about tax increment, and I know a lot about taxation, but I don't know. I'm not a municipal lawyer type that could tell you whether they've got. Clearly, the city can do it. What I'm unclear about is whether the county would have authority to, say, levy and then contribute money to the county. That would be, you know, a little bit of a unusual. It is true. The law would not actually allow it in a circumstance like this, but it is true that the county, the city, and the school can do can use what's called the abatement law to do something that's very similar to this, and it would work mechanically in many ways the same way, because each of them then has to approve the use of their property taxes for an economic development project. And so functionally it would work like that. Now there's a problem in that you cannot use abatement on a TIF district, including after the TIF district has been decertified for a period of time, and so they could not use the abatement law to actually do that. Again, I think the thing to keep in mind about this is that essentially, rather than giving, what you need to think about in terms of the precedent is, is it important for each of the taxing districts to be able to veto an extension? Or is the interest that they have to prevent an extension from capturing their taxes? That's essentially the choice that you all have to decide. Whether it's important to make. Is it important that they control their taxes, or that they prevent the city and the county in this instance from going ahead and using tax increment to fill in this gap that the city has experienced?
Representative Vogel?
Mr. Chair, I think this is going to be laid over for inclusion, but maybe one of the things to explore might be if there are other alternatives that could be used without tampering with this part of the law, because I do have some reservations relative to where it could be expanded to, and especially already I understand the benefit that the school district and the county get from a TIF, but expanding that further tends to, you know, possibly weaken their position relative to things that could happen in the future. So. Maybe just a suggestion to the committee it's assigned to maybe explore.
Thank you, Representative Vogel. Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And, you know, I have to tell you that I'm not a huge TIF fan in general. Because we do see a number of these bills come before the committees with respect to, you know, extension requests or new TIF districts or whatever the case may be, You are kind of forced into forming an opinion or taking a position on TIF. And in my mind, I've kind of come to the conclusion that because it is such a localized issue, I kind of rely heavily on, you know, input from the local authorities as well as the local representative that perhaps represents that district. And in this case, I have to say that, you know, members, we set precedent all the time. That is not a new thing. That is kind of what we do here. And I don't think that in this particular case, I think what we're seeing here is kind of an outside-the-box way of thinking to solve a problem. And I can appreciate the efforts of the city in what they're doing, and I think we all could appreciate the fact that, you know, we'd like to see them complete this project, and if this action helps them do that, you know, why wouldn't we support it? But I think if we look at the bill exactly, you know, in the precedent that we may be setting, what we're doing here is we're holding the school district harmless, financially at least. Because if we don't do anything and we don't approve the extension, the school district will receive X amount of funds. If we do take a positive action on this bill and it is included and signed into law, the school district will receive the same amount of funds. Now, we could get into a long debate about, you know, whether the school district should or should not support the TIF district and participate, but that's really not what the bill is about. So I see this as a positive step for the city. I don't think it's precedent-setting in a negative way. because at the very least we're holding, you know, the school district harmless in this case financially. And as long as the city and the way the bill is written requires essentially city approval, if one or more of the three local units were to approve the special law, I think that we're setting up a situation where as long as the city is in agreement and they can live with that situation and that scenario of excluding the school district, I think it makes good sense. So I for one, would support the bill and encourage you, Mr. Chair, to take a look at it pretty closely.
Thank you, Representative Simonson. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and let me thank Representative Simonson as well for his articulate comments there. I think they built a strong base for supporting this legislation. Oddly enough, yesterday I got a tweet from somebody, I think it was a tweet, from District 191 saying they're facing real financial hardships in putting together their budget for next year, and they really need a 3% increase on the formula. And I think a piece of this is that, you know, school districts are being funded at a, I don't know, 2005 level if you look at inflation, while demands on those school districts have increased. And I would assume, not having been involved in any of the conversations with either Egan or the county or the school district, I would assume that they were being prudent with their funds that they get and saying the demands and our needs are great enough that we can't go here. We have a first obligation to meet the needs of our students, and that's appropriate. We approved this last year. I think we approved two TIF districts for Egan last year.
Yeah, I think the second one was
Mr. McGuire.
Much less significant. But yes, that's Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney. I think that's correct.
It was
a smaller one up north. Yeah,
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is of the two. This is the one I liked. But that's the nature of conference committee. So if the other one were in front of us, I might say very different things. But I guess I would remind the committee that the precedent that created the situation was the recession. We were devastated, and construction stopped. And that was hard on our communities who had development opportunities and job creation opportunities that they were trying to move forward on. It was hard on our constituents who were looking to go to work and weren't able to for a long time. And I think if we're concerned about precedent, I would rather we focus first on the precedent of the recession that created the problem rather than the precedent of a creative problem solving that importantly holds the school district harmless and allows everybody else to move on and accomplish closing up this deal and the development that it allows Egan. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just wanted to express my concern about, somewhat what Representative Simonson referred to, but the starting with lines 2.3 on page 2, and that which proceeds through clause 3. I realize that the school district will be held harmless, but it seems to me that if we would enact this, then we would be giving carte blanche to other school districts as well, and yet they would get their payments, even though their state aid would have to be calculated differently. And I'm not sure that we want to go down that path. I wish there were a different solution to help Egan, but I just wanted to express my concerns. You know, I know the school district didn't probably want to participate because there would be an increase in property taxes to their folks. But then again, this provision holds them harmless, and then other school districts could do likewise. And then in the end, we would have to do how state aid payments are made in districts that have this. So we might be making the K-12 formula even more complicated.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, it looks like your total TIF project was to capture about $200 million of development, and 151 of it completed. And you note under construction the Cedar Grove apartments with retail at $24 million. My question to you is, was that construction started during this last year when you thought you had an extension? Did it start after the end of the or expiration of the TIF district, or did that get in underneath the belt?
Mr. McGuire.
The deadline?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertogs, I'll turn over to Mr. Hohenstein if I'm not completely aware. I think the question you're asking essentially is, before the special legislation, was the city already obliged, or has it taken on more obligations since the legislation? The answer is we have taken on no more obligations since the legislation. All costs and such that are reflected in the legislation are still in place today, and were done prior to.
Representative Hertas.
Mr. Chair, testifiers, I guess I wanted to know whether or not the decision for Cedar Grove to go ahead was part of the tax increment consideration.
Mr. McGuire.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm not clear. The tax increment financing district has been ongoing since 2003, and this legislation really is about the finance and administration of that district. The active economic development of that district and redevelopment of that district has been continuing, and is continuing. At this point, the city has expended funds to assemble land, to do public improvements, to encourage private development of the land, and the district is the core of the district, has seen some development at this point. There's other development that is approved. Some construction on that has started. All of the knowables in terms of increment production off of projects that either are approved or have been started to be constructed or have been constructed and completed are all included in the estimates of total increment over the life of the district. I'm trying to answer your question as completely as I can. I'm not sure if that does or not.
No, it does not. Okay.
Representative Hertas.
When did it start? When did Cedar Grove start construction?
Mr. McGuire.
Mr. Hohenstein, 2002, I believe. Is that right?
Mr. Hohenstein.
Mr. Chair, a representative. The district was certified in 2003. Most of the early activities involved acquisition and preparing the property for redevelopment. It did involve acquiring and assembling those properties because they were laid out around an old highway with frontage roads and so on. It just was not laid out for new development. So construction of those improvements, preparation for those things, started in 2003, and there's actually an intersection project that started before that in 2002. So there's been a lot of activity. The most substantial construction has begun in the last couple of years when the Twin Cities Premium Outlets occurred. And at this point, going forward, there's still construction to occur, but hopefully all of those properties will be sold for market rate. Ordinary development conditions will apply. There won't be a need for additional expenditures. Really, at this point, the issue is trying to recover what we anticipate to be the gap from those earlier expenditures affected by the delay in the recession.
So Cedar Grove...
Representative Hertas.
Cedar Grove was a phased part of the development, and it has overlapped the expiration of the original TIF, is what you're saying.
Mr. Hohenstein.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the term of the TIF district runs until 2029. It has not ceased to exist yet. But in doing projections out to that point, based on what we know today, there is a gap that can be covered by a three-year extension of the city and county.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you. I guess I then view this as being 80 or 90% completed, and that $24 million is part of the 151. So thanks for that clarification.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Hearing none, the chair will lay over House File 1299 for possible inclusion. Thank you. Representative Mason, do you have any concluding comments you'd like to make?
I just want to thank you very much for the discussion and for your consideration.
Thank you, Representative Mason. Thank you, Mr. McGuire, Mr. Hohenstein. The chair will lay over House File 1299 for possible inclusion. And Representative Pinto, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, I move House File 609.
Representative Pinto moves House File 609 for possible and to be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Pinto. Please introduce your bill and then your guests.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 609 is a bill that would give the City of St. Paul some flexibility for the possible use of tax increment financing at the Ford site. It's a 120-acre site in my district that's a pretty compact urban district, so 120 acres is a pretty substantial chunk of it, as you can imagine. The Ford Motor Company had an assembly plant there for nearly 90 years, and there's really no site like it in the country as far as I'm aware, with the potential that this site has. I'm going to turn things over to testifier in just a second, but I want to note that there's a House research bill summary that I think maybe indicates that the bill as drafted is a little bit broader in terms of completing the intent of the city. And so I guess what I encourage members to do is to hear from the testifier, who's Jonathan Sage Martinson, Director of Planning and Economic Development for the City of St. Paul, as far as exactly what the bill is intended to do, and then we can discuss the details from there. And, Mr. Chair, I'll probably have a couple concluding remarks when Mr. Sage Martinson is done.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. If you would even spell your name for us as you introduce yourself.
Yeah, happy to do that. Thanks, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I am Jonathan Sage Martinson. So the last name is two words. It's Sage, S-A-G-E, hyphen Martinson, M-A-R-T-I-N-S-O-N.
Thank you.
And I'm the Director of Planning and Economic Development with the City of St. Paul. Thanks for hearing this bill this morning. Thanks, Representative Pinto, for carrying the bill. This bill asks for flexibility for around the TIF law, around two aspects for the Ford Motor Company site, which is this unique site in St. Paul with a unique time frame, size, and complexity that we think warrants these couple of exceptions. The first exception is around the certification date to give us a longer time period in which to certify the district, and the second is to allow us within the same Ford site to do multiple TIF districts. Since March 2013, Ford, who owns the site, has been working to do demolition and environmental testing on this total of 144 acres if you take the full site together. They've been working diligently at that, and their hope is by the latter half of this year to put the site on the market. We're anticipating it'll be another 2 years for a master developer to do due diligence and to close on the property. And there will be additional cleanup going through, we think, 2017. So there is some time yet before we know have the developer in place and all the cleanup done on the site. In your packet, we provided a copy of the anticipated time frame for all of the activities on the site. The city established blight findings for this site in February 2013 for the buildings on the site just before the demolition began in March. So under current TIF law, we would have to certify a district by March of 2016 when the testing and demolition is still underway here today in 2015. And so we're asking for an additional 4 years in which to certify that district, so we have some additional time for the demolition, the environmental testing, and the developer to be in place. Without this flexibility, we have the ability today to certify a TIF district on the site because of the blight finding, but we'd have to do that by March 2016 to do one entire TIF district on the site. And again, we're not sure whether we'll need it. We're not sure whether we'll need it over the entire site, so we're asking for some additional time to make that determination. The second thing we're asking for is the ability within the site to do multiple TIF districts as opposed to one TIF district. We expect development on the site. Again, it's 144 acres total. We expect development on the site to take a couple of development cycles, so it could be 10 years plus from the beginning of construction until the site is fully built out. And rather than do one large TIF district, we think it would be more efficient to actually do multiple smaller TIF districts that match the development as it unfolds, so that we can match sort of the TIF need with the development phasing and use the proceeds more efficiently that way. So in essence, what we're asking for is the ability to use the TIF in sort of a surgical way, instead of as a sledgehammer, and just sort of using our one tool and using the entire site as a TIF district. We want to do these multiple TIF districts as development proceeds and as we know our need. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate the chance to talk about the bill. Hoping you'll help us with this flexibility so that we have some more time to decide whether or not we want to use TIF. We're not sure today whether or not we want to use it on the site, and that we have the ability to match it to the development cycle, sort of use it more specifically. With that, we're happy to take questions, and I think Representative Pinto has a few other remarks.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I should note we're joined by Jenny Wolf, who's the debt administrator for the Housing and Redevelopment Authority for the City of St. Paul, who'll be available for questions as well. So I just wanted to make sure to clarify a couple things. The City of St. Paul has made a blight finding with respect to the property, and I'll ask Mr. Sage Martinson to correct me anything that I say that's wrong here, but I'm just thinking about being in your shoes and assessing this. The House Research Bill Summary talks about they're not needing to meet the blight test, but in fact the finding was made in March of 2013. So under current law, as Mr. Sage Martinson said, March of 2016 then would be the three-year limit for the city to then declare a district. And because, I should say, I was out on the site just a couple weeks ago. Again, demolition began March of 2013, and the site kind of from afar looks, it's been completely cleared, but as you get closer, you realize that they are still working through the foundations of all the buildings. This is all continuing, and it's been going on for a couple years. It's going to keep on going just to clear the site, and then the environmental testing. So the three-year limitation under current law, I think part of the thinking is just that this does not fit as well a site of this kind. It's just a really different kind of a location. And then, as Mr. Chase Martinson said, just clarifying this point that trying to have a set of smaller districts as opposed to one large district, there's a point that's made in the House Research Summary about trying to avoid, have this be an exception to the five-year limit for spending TIF funds, and that, as I understand from the city, is not the intent of the city. To try to get around that within any one of these smaller districts. So just want to make sure to clarify that point. And finally, I want to point out that unlike the last bill, the county and the school district, you'll see from papers that you have, are fully on board with this. They're fully supportive. All the taxing entities are supportive of this. This is a very important project to my district. There's been a ton of community involvement, a series of meetings going on. This actually started back in 2007. I first attended my first task force meeting. This is how long it's been going on. A couple hundred people every time there's a meeting on this, but it has great importance, I think, to the region as a whole. And with that, we'll take questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I may be a Minneapolis guy, and this may be St. Paul, but this is an extraordinary site. The loss of Ford Motor is a significant loss of a significant piece of history to the entire Twin Cities. In fact, when I taught in Buffalo, I had students whose parents worked at the Ford Motor Company site in St. Paul, which was a heck of a schlep. Every day for them, but it's a remarkable site in its potential. I can only imagine it's also a remarkable site in its challenge. The environmental concerns were probably not the same 90 years ago as they are today, and the potential for some significant costs in environmental remediation alone have to be considerable. So there's some huge opportunity here. It's an extraordinary site. But also there's some real challenges. So I appreciate the City of St. Paul coming forward and asking for some flexibility that I think this site requires. That said, Mr. Sage Martinson, who owns the ball fields? I believe they are referred to as the Ford ball fields, and would they be threatened by any of this, or do I need to bring an amendment forward in case this is included in the omnibus bill?
Mr. Sage Martinson.
Chairman, Representative Dabney, the ball fields are owned by Ford Motor Company, so they're part of the land owned by Ford and will be part of the land that's put up for sale by Ford. Ford has been very amenable to the relationship with the Little League in terms of use of the ball fields. So the Little League manages the site and manages the use of the fields and has been in very close conversation with us about trying to find a location either on the site or nearby for the ball fields as the redevelopment happens. They're very important to the community and are sort of top of mind to everyone working on the site.
Representative Dabney?
Well, then the expanded ability to use increment outside of the
the TIF district, I hope one of the first priorities would be the ball fields. The bleachers could use a little attention, as could the backstops. but Mr. Chair, the Highland Little League, a force to be reckoned with.
Wow. Thank you, Representative Devaney. So TIF to build the bleachers or cheap seats.
I think that would be an appropriate use of increment. And Mr. Chair, if we could work jointly on an amendment, if you include this in the division report, I'd be glad to work with you on that.
Thank you. Look forward to Representative Devaney. Mr. Michael, and I am not one of those city people like Representative Simonson and others who has been through this before, and so my mind is still trying to understand TIF, but this is obviously a special law being brought forward or proposed here. Are HRAs, how often do HRAs initiate TIFs? My understanding is it's normally a city, or is it real commonplace?
Mr. Chairman, it is very... TIF is controlled by cities, but the actual entities that typically do TIF are called development authorities, and those routinely are economic development authorities, HRAs, and port authorities. Cities have a limited ability under the municipal development law to do TIF directly, but usually it's done through these entities like HRAs and EDAs. So that's common.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. These maps are interesting, and I've not been to the site. The Canadian Pacific Rail property, does that end, or does that go into the Ford plant, and is there a rail switching yard there? What about that rail property?
Mr. Sage Martinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, you'll see on the site there, you can see the rail yard, the CP rail yard, that the blue line, the edge of the Ford Motor Company. If it's black and white, it may be difficult to see. I'm happy to pass my map over there. But
is that the blue line or the green line, Mr. Sage Martinson? Sorry, I couldn't resist.
Yes, we would actually love a connection there. The CP Rail Yard is owned by CP Rail and goes into the site, so to speak, because the Ford Motor Company land jogs around it. The rail line itself formerly went from that rail yard into the Ford site to deliver goods and services. That has since been cut off at the edge of the Ford property. But you'll see where you see the storage yard and the rail cars stored is in fact CP Rail yard, owned by CP Rail.
Representative Anderson?
Well, no, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up, so their tracks end there, and they still utilize it, but it doesn't pass through the property. It just ends there, and they'd have to go back out the same way they came in, correct?
Looks like a parking lot, Representative Anderson. Mr. Yes. Sage Martinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, it is no longer in use. So it was built solely to that end to serve the Ford Motor Company site. Since it's closed, the Ford Motor Company site's closed. They no longer use that portion of CP Rail.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm looking at the tentative timeline, and I'm noticing the environmental assessment period stretching in. So I'm wondering, were there delays in getting the assessment done? Is this normally, you said some of this activity started in 07, and we show it going through three quarters of 2015. I'm trying to understand, was there some untoward thing that showed up that is causing additional delay, or is this just the normal very slow process you go through for anything that affects the environmental impact statements?
Mr. Sage Martinson.
Chair, Representative Quam, the reference to 2007 was when Ford first announced they were going to close the plant. They extended its life for a couple of times, so it didn't actually close until 2013, I believe. So 2007 was the kickoff of our planning effort around the site, which continues today. The environmental testing has occurred since Ford closed around the buildings, and as the buildings have come down and they've pulled up the slabs, they've done additional testing where the buildings used to be and where the slabs used to be. So The testing has not been gone on since 2007, but it still is a lengthy process given the vast majority of the site that was covered by buildings and by concrete slabs, so that they've, as Representative Pinto said, just the last few months they've pulled up the last of those slabs and now working on the foundations. They've been able to get in and do testing where previously they couldn't because there was a building over that part of the site.
Representative Quam?
Thank you. So it's a long process. You haven't found any. You were not looking at a hidden Superfund style site or other issues. That it, you know, part of what you're asking for extension is because the processes that Minnesota as a state has involved with environmental issues are so long that you can't get this done in the normal time frame.
Mr. Sage Martinson.
Chair, Representative Quam, I would say it's both the process that that needs to go on, but perhaps most importantly here, just the sheer size of the site, 144 acres, vast majority of it covered with buildings. We anticipate that the environmental testing will be done this year with reports completed by the end of the year if weather and all of that time frame holds.
Representative Pinto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Quam, I don't believe that the issue is requirements imposed by the state in this case. It's just, I mean, literally, there's still material being lifted up to find out what's underneath it. You know, you just, I mean, I think it's just a matter of not being able to even look until the material's up and it's taken that long to remove it. I mean, 140 acres pretty much entirely covered up and it has to all be lifted up and then all be tested, and there's just a lot of stuff there. So I don't think that it's an outside imposition by the state. I think it's just a matter of it just the sheer size and nature of the site has just taken a long time to work through. I'll let Mr. Sage Martinson correct me if that's wrong.
That's right.
144 acres, that'd be a nice-sized cornfield, Representative Pinto.
Mr. Chair, going out there at stretch, I actually was thinking about my kids wanting to run around and play soccer on there. Yeah, it's quite big. Yeah, quite big.
Yeah, and if we put a cornfield on Representative Dabney, the MPCA would show up a little faster.
Maybe so, but if this were South Minneapolis as opposed to St. Paul, the cornfield probably would have been suggested in community.
other questions? No water gardens. Any other questions? Representative Pinto, any closing remarks?
I just want to thank the committee very much. I really think this site has enormous potential for our whole region, and I do want to say, I think it was Representative Anderson said he hadn't been to the site. If anyone would like a tour, it is absolutely fascinating. And we didn't even get to the power plant and the place by the river, and so it's quite an amazing site, so we'd love to offer that. Thank you so much to the committee. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Pinto, and thank you, Mr. Sage Martinson and Ms. Wolf for coming today. With that, members, the chair will lay House File 609 over for possible inclusion. And members, I think that concludes our agenda for today. Any announcements that people have before we break early? Thank you, members. With that, the meeting is adjourned.